Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, while Billy Joel's Pressure is fading out in the background. This is the episode of August 19, 2021, and as always, you're listening to Consumer on all of the different podcast platforms. Please do consider recommending this podcast to a friend if you like it, and keep listening. We'll have weekly episodes every Thursday. So I have a very interesting episode for you today. My guest this week is Zurab Chiabarashvili. Hopefully I'm not butchering this name too much. He is a Georgian of international esteem. He's currently holding a professor position at the Ilya State University and has been in and out of politics in the Republic of Georgia. He was the mayor of Tbilisi, which is the capital of Georgia, from 2004 to 2005. He was minister of labor, health and social affairs in 2012 and governor of the Kakheti region in 2013. He also served as the permanent representative of Georgia to the Council of Europe between 2005 and 2010, and to the UN office and other organizations in Geneva between 2011 and 2012. He also teaches at different universities, and he translated John Rawls's Political Liberalism into Georgian. So very high-standing guest coming later in this episode. But first, we will be talking about Facebook. Facebook is taking over the platform customer. But the European Union isn't too happy, so I will be chatting with my colleague Jalasowski about that topic. Also, the Right to Die activists are making breakthroughs in Italy. And lastly, we'll also be talking about an interesting little infographic I've seen on Facebook by the Dutch Cycling Embassy, and they make some rather odd comparisons. So let's get started. So first off, we have the Dutch Cycling Embassy, one of these environmental groups that posted an interesting infographic on their Facebook page, which gathered quite a lot of attention. And I'll be posting a link in the description of this podcast for you to check it out if you'd like. But overall, they compare the different methods of transport. They call it transport energy efficiency. And they compare cycling, walking, tram, bus, electric, rail, heavy rail, motorcycles, cars, flying, taxis, and lorries. And they come to the conclusion that cycling, by the way, is better than walking, which I'm not entirely sure how that works. At least not if you're not taking into account the production emissions created by the production of a bicycle or e-bike. And there's also a few things overall that seem to be problematic. So they say here that they count this entire infographic in the megajoules per passenger kilometer traveled. So not entirely sure if that's really the emissions standard produced. It's really hard how to say. Also, taxis are judged worse than cars. There again, the production necessity, like the production emissions of producing a car, doesn't seem to be accounted for, because otherwise, of course, you'd be better served taking a taxi than taking your own car. Another thing that is striking is that the aircraft they're using in their comparison, to say what, you know, what it would be for flying, is the Boeing 727, which actually isn't being produced anymore. I believe even since 2010 or something, that aircraft is actually not in production anymore. So very antiquated data being used here. And overall, there's a lot of problems here. They consider the London Underground as being heavy rail. You know, overall, I don't have a problem with these kind of comparisons and putting that into an infographic to make it to give it more visibility for consumers and make them aware as to like what it exactly means to have their different methods of transport being used and which one is more efficient and better for the environment. But this one, it's just not working out. And I'm not quite sure what they're trying to do here. Because the comparison leads to believe that cycling, of course, is the only thing you're supposed to be doing, which, of course, the Facebook page being the Dutch Cycling Embassy, is not too surprising. But tampering with the data and using all data to get your point across is really not what we should be doing. But then again, you can make up your own mind. There will be a link in the description of this podcast, so you can go check it out and see for yourself. In other news then, Facebook is trying to acquire the business platform Customr, and the European Union isn't too happy about that. The European Union says that Facebook is getting too big. And so I chatted with my colleague Jan Lasowski, who's been doing a lot on the whole social media network controversy. And let's see what he had to say. So Jan, the European Commission says that it is looking into Facebook buying Customr. And there's other examples as well. In the United States, the FTC was looking into the social media monopoly-like situation that Facebook seems to have by owning WhatsApp and Instagram, making it too big in the social media spectrum. Your view on what is happening in Europe, but also the overall question of, like, can companies in the social media spectrum get too big? Is there such a thing? Is that a problem for consumers?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point that's brought up, because this is all through the prism of power, and it's between different political jurisdictions. So in this particular case, we're talking about Customr with a K, Inc. So this is a U.S. company. Surprise, surprise, U.S. tech firm in Europe, try to get it regulated to death. And in this, they are attempting to sell their assets to Facebook. And it was I believe it was around $1 billion was the offer. They've already announced it. Customr is sort of an online platform that you use for client relationship manager, also for messaging. It's perfect for people who use different commerce websites on their own personal sites or on their business sites. So anyone can understand why this is a valuable thing. Where Facebook will take it, we don't know. And that's what the market is all about. It's about making these risks, taking a risk, putting out money, acquiring, whether it be capital or talent, and seeing what comes of it. Now, the role of the European Union in this and the role of other governments is they want to come in and say, stop, this is too much, because this is going to somehow make it a monopoly in this particular space. For this, they don't necessarily have an argument, because what Customr is, it is a service that has basically put together all these amazing tools. You have this talent. They've gotten funding from all these different people around the world. And how Facebook will use this, we don't really know. So it's very easy for institutions like the European Union or the American Federal Trade Commission to go back and say, hey, that purchase of WhatsApp, hey, that purchase of Instagram, that made you too big. But you know, this is the kind of thing where we see innovators butting heads with regulators who have a totally different agenda. They're not thinking about consumers or customers or users. They're mostly just thinking about the tax implications and the revenue. And if you look into a company like Customr, they follow all the rules in the European Union. They have GDPR. They follow all the rules in the United States and even in California, which has a more extensive privacy legislation. So they're doing everything they can, and they're very happy, and they willingly sell to someone like Facebook. I don't see the need for the European regulators to get involved, surely because A, it's an American company, but also B, this is not going to create a monopoly anywhere. There are plenty of different competitors in this space. Salesforce is a good one. You have things like HubSpot. There are all these different companies that provide these services. It just seems to me that the EU is just trying to get ahead of the ball and stop some type of innovation so they can say that they, quote unquote, helped the user or consumer. But I really don't think that's the case.
So the political argument there is interesting, Yael. So would you say that if Spotify were to purchase an American competitor, that this would not be a conversation that they'd be having, because Spotify being a European company, that would not come into question?
I think you're definitely inching towards something that speaks to this. It is a little bit about economic nationalism. And there's been a lot of debates in the European Parliament about what can we do to have a European Google or a European Facebook. And I do think if Spotify was up and made some acquisition, and they likely will, it's a growing company, a lot of users, I think that they basically wouldn't have the same level of scrutiny. And this is just because it is an EU-based company. You have a lot of people who are involved who come from Sweden, where is their base, and many other European countries. I really do believe that they would not have the same level of scrutiny. So a lot of this, we have to be very skeptical when it comes to regulation, when it comes to these type of lawsuits, when it comes to investigations. Let's look at the origin of those companies and really what the goal is. Is the goal to make sure that an app or a website like Customr is not just bought up by Facebook to destroy it? really, that's what we have to look at. And unfortunately, too much of this is just tied up into questions of which company is European, where are the headquarters, where do they pay taxes? And that has very little to do with whether you or I like this app, use it, it provides value to us. And that's really what we have to try to reinsert into the conversation about, particularly regulation on technology, is that it's all about consumers and users and providing value. And the role for legislators is to allow that to happen, to set ground rules. And that's really about it. When we have cases of fraud or abuse, definitely things to be put through legislative muster, to put through the justice system. But until then, I see it as a bit overzealous on the part of the EU.
In other news then, Politico is titling The Right to Die Activists Hope for a Breakthrough in Italy. So this is a very interesting story. There was an assisted suicide case, or a requested assisted suicide case, of a 43-year-old spinal injury patient who was being identified only as Mario. And this person would like or would be eligible to for assisted suicide in Italy if that were to be legal. And it seems that politically things are moving now in Italy, because according to polls, as many as 9 out of 10 Italians are in favor of assisted suicide, also known as euthanasia in some countries. I know the experience of Luxembourg, which has legalized it, I think, back in 2009. And essentially what it means is that if you sign a certain set of documents and you find yourself in a situation where you could be eligible for assisted suicide, then that is your right, and your family does not have the ultimate say in that, because you express that ultimate say in those documents. I think this is great. I think this provides, I mean, it's obviously a very difficult topic to talk about. Death is not the most uplifting regulatory topic to talk about, but I think it's very important to give individuals the right to choose for themselves how they want to be treated in those kind of situations. Very often you see these patients and they're on different types of machines and just being kept alive. And of course the there is pain medication, but we ultimately don't know exactly how it feels to those people. It's hard to really understand what sort of state of mind or pain they are in. And that's why it's, in my view, really important that we leave those choices up to patients, how they want to be treated in those scenarios. Nobody is making it compulsory for anyone to choose anything, but that option should be available. And I'm really surprised and happy that Italy, which is considered more of a religious country, is going that way. I know that in the Benelux states, for us, this is already something that we've had for a while, but I'm very happy that other countries are coming around to it. And there's a lot to do in this area. I know that Switzerland has also been very advanced in this area, and that a lot of Europeans are going to Switzerland in order to claim their right to die in a respectable fashion. Because, of course, we also need to realize that patients, when they are being stripped of that choice that they would like to have, they find alternatives. And those alternatives can be very dangerous, very problematic for those patients and the people surrounding them. It is much better to have an organized system in which they can work with healthcare professionals who know what they're doing and do it in the most professional manner. Of course, a lot of controversy around that topic. I know that a lot of people wouldn't probably not be agreeing with me, but I believe that the individual choice of patients, how they want to live their life and how they want to govern their medical complications should be up to them. But now let's move to the interview of this week. We are chatting to Zurab Chiaberashvili, who is currently holding a professor position at the Ilia State University and joined public service in 2003 as the chairman of the Central Election Commission of the Republic of Georgia. He's been in and out of politics, and he has a CV that is really has something to show for itself. He's been an ambassador and minister in government, the governor of a region. He's also been the mayor of Tbilisi. So he's been in a lot of different positions, also as an educator, working as a professor. So I wanted to ask him questions about the Republic of Georgia, how it stands towards the European Union, and also the incredible economic miracle that the Republic of Georgia has achieved after coming out of the oppression of the Soviet Union, which was a collectivist system which didn't allow for any free market economy. So it was very, very interesting to chat with him and to learn more about Georgia, which is a European country in nature for sure. So apologies also for the audio. There were some technical difficulties. I've tried to clean up the audio a bit. You might have to increase the audio levels on your device or wherever you're listening. But I hope you will be able to take away as much as I did.
And of course, how that was achieved is very much related to the motto of the new government, that we need to deregulate our economy, that state has to withdraw itself from certain areas, and by doing that, promote free trade, free economy, and by doing that, help attracting more FDI, and I'll give you some numbers after. But let me start with corruption. People sometimes, when we speak about corruption, most people think about rule of law, how a rule of law agencies has to punish somebody for the misconduct. And people sometimes omit from the view importance of deregulation, especially in developing countries. In the countries where rule of law has a long, several century tradition, it's not a problem. So it's that state may have little bit more involvement in our affairs. It's a problem from my ideological point of view. But people may don't consider that relevant when we speak about corruption in developed countries. But in a country where there is no rules of rule of law, more power states have and the more discretion state authorities have, more corrupted they become. And that's why we started fighting corruption not only on one side with improving rule of law, but on the other side, deregulating economy and leaving least discretion in hands of bureaucrats. Otherwise, bureaucrats will always find a way how to extort more money from a citizen, from a customer, the state institution has to provide service. So this tool was very important from the beginning. And this, just to give you a number, for example, in 2005, number of permits and licenses were 909. And in 2012, it was only 55 permits and licenses. And one striking example is checking cars with emission, just to check with how technically the car is at the normal level. It was very corrupted agency in 2003 and 2004, and instead of trying to reform the agency, we preferred for a while to abolish it completely. Because our philosophy at that time was that just having bureaucracy without a trust and without feasible, without a feasibility that it can be transformed within 2-3 years in a proper manner, we decided not to have this technical inspection of cars practically for a decade. And it was reintroduced afterwards. Georgia had signed a free trade agreement with the European Union. So it was a precondition of that agreement in 2014. Right. So it is very extreme example, but the number I gave you, just the number of permits and licenses, tells you how drastic was the cut of state bureaucracy and discretions state bureaucracy had. Now, let me move a little bit on another area, which was tax collection, because now we can debate about how much taxes has to be. I prefer the lower the taxes are, the better for our private citizens and better for the functioning of a state based on rule of law and freedom of choice. Despite the fact that before 2004, Georgia had 24 types of taxes and tax burden was about 30%, if I remember correctly, the state was able to collect only 7% of GDP as tax. But from the moment, on one hand, we fought against corruption, reduced bureaucracy, gave a breath to economy, and the economy grew. I will tell you the numbers later on. By 2012, state was able to collect 24% of GDP as taxes. Though number of taxes being reduced from 24 to 6, and total tax burden, of course, decreased significantly, and currently is between 25 and 26% of GDP. So it also tells you that with lower taxes, we've been able to collect more, and with least bureaucracy, we've been able to provide more and better services for citizens than it was before. If someone checks the Georgia's index in Transparency International Corruption Index, of course we improve. And of course, I would suggest also to check Georgian numbers over the years in easing of doing business index. Georgia was in 2006 at 112th place, and 2014 we 8th place. So it tells you how fast and how drastic was improvement in that regard. So this is in a nutshell what was the idea behind the success. Of course, I didn't tell you yet, but I can say a few words about the GDP growth, which was 925 USD in 2004, and currently it is 4600. So we are not satisfied, because between 2004 and 12, when we had right-wing government, I was the part of preferring the lower taxation, low debt to GDP percentage, et cetera, et cetera. We had on average 6.5% GDP growth, and we have lower since we have now from 2013, we have a left-wing government preferring preferring more left-wing policies on that regard, and heavily dependent on state bureaucracy rather than that private citizens' free choice.
So I have a few questions. So first, on the last point, because you just mentioned it now, what I think is interesting there is that in Europe we seem to be going in the opposite direction. I think France has something over 250 different taxes, and the tax burden is very high on people.
You are certainly no stranger to the European Union institutions, and you've been in and out all over the continent. What are the reactions that you get in Europe when you bring this up, when you show the real-life experience of the Laffer curve that actually Georgia has shown to be the case, you know, reducing tax burdens, increasing tax revenue? How is that received when you talk to European ambassadors and politicians? How does that go?
It depends whom you talk to. You talk to bureaucrats, they are very suspicious about the reforms we've conducted from 2004. If you talk to business people, they easily understand how important it is to give more freedom to private business and citizens. So it depends whom you talk to. The important thing is that it's not only in the Western Europe, but sometimes here in Georgia also, there is famous phrase that look at Germany or look at France, what are the regulations there? So, but my response always is that please take France, Germany, or Sweden with the same GDP per capita and see what kind of regulations they had in 30s or 40s or 50s. We have to compare Georgia to France of $4,500 USD per capita. Because more chains you put on economy in very underdeveloped economy, more you put a brake on economic growth. And you need economic growth in order to have more citizens least dependent on the state benefits, social benefits, and you need GDP growth and more revenues in the state budget for providing social benefits for those who are in need of those social benefits. And by the way, those who have been right-wing government, it was us who introduced targeted social assistance in 2006, and which, according to World Bank data, was a primary source for reduction of poverty from 2006 since introduction till 2010. But then World Bank says that from 10 to 14, the number one poverty reduction tool became economic growth. So you have to do it parallel. You have to push economic growth with this minimum state ideology, least regulation, lower taxes. But on the other hand, you have to think about of those who cannot catch up with the economic growth. And by helping them also, you make also politically now these reforms acceptable for wider society, not only for those who can directly benefit from economics.
I had another question, which was about the licensing that you mentioned, the reduction in the overall licensing that are required. I know that in Western Europe, the entire conversation about occupational licensing and different permits that you need is often associated with the critique, like if I were to argue like, oh, many of these permits, they're not necessary. The counterpoint is often the precautionary principle. If somebody has a license, we know that they are qualified. If they get a permit, we know that it is regulated and safe. The precautionary principle is very popular in Western Europe. That's one of the main arguments used. Did you have those same the same pushback in Georgia, or what did that look like? Because you were talking about a significant reduction in regulatory burden there.
If anybody speaks not about her or his business sector, everybody is for more freedom and less license. But when it comes to a specific sector a person is involved in, then preference for licensing increasing, because everybody wants to be protective of its own, if not monopolistic, monopolistic bargaining power, but anyway, to protect its own sector. And especially funds of regulation are not from the private sector, but from the bureaucrat, because I repeat, in a country which very limited experience of rule of law, bureaucracy understands that in terms of its own income. I didn't mention before, but income inside bureaucracy was extremely low before Rose Revolution. And of course, when salaries are 30 USD per month or 40 USD per month, you understand that state bureaucracy has another income rather than from the state treasury. And of course, it's linked with corruption. So in countries like Georgia, it's understood as an income for state bureaucracy. One I didn't mention that before Rose Revolution, and it still remains so, Georgia was very low unit. Georgia was not unionized country, so we don't have strong unions here. And I think maybe it was, we will be very strange for European viewer or listener, but I think that that's the advantage, not a barrier for Georgia. Why advantage? Because it then more the reformist government we've been, it was easy for us to implement certain policies which otherwise, in case of unions being strong, would be difficult to implement. So that made our transformation very rapid, very fast, and gave us results quite rapidly. For example, one important number I have to give you is, for example, number of FTA to GDP, which is striking. In 2007, I couldn't find it in my files, but in 2007, FDI reached 17% of GDP, which was huge money for Georgia in percentages. Of course, still it's 1.8 billion only USD, and it's maybe nothing for Western European countries if we take in nominal terms FDI. But in terms of FDI to GDP, it was huge money inflow to Georgia, and it was already in 2007, which tells you that the reforms we started in 2004 attracted a lot of investors, and it was the key in transformation process.
I only have time for one more question in the time that we have for our format, but this is a question that I am really interested by. Georgia is currently a part of the Eastern Partnership Agreement, where there's also, if I'm not mistaken, Armenia and Azerbaijan. Of those three countries, Georgia seems by far the best prepared. Ukraine and Moldova, apologies. All right. Thank you for correcting the record. I think even considering Ukraine and Moldova, Georgia seems to be the best prepared to for all the economic factors and so on. But in a hypothetical scenario in which Georgia were to be a member of the European Union, I'm originally from Luxembourg, and Luxembourg tries to pride itself in low regulatory burden, easy business making, reasonable tax planning, Now, our neighbors in France are not a big fan of that. In a scenario in which Georgia were to be a part of the European Union, would it not struggle to combine the easiness of doing business with the increasing requirements of the European Union when it comes to financial overview, regulatory systems that are being put in place in Brussels? Would those be able to work together? Would Georgia in the EU be able to function as the Georgia that it is today?
Great question. First, let me explain to your viewers that our push for first NATO membership and afterwards membership in the European Union is for the historic reasons. We, since ancient times, we've been considering ourselves as a part of the ancient Greek that time, and then Byzantine Empire, and this is the historic our historic linkages with Europe, and that's why we push for it. There is a political element in that, and the membership in NATO and the European Union for us is considered as to be secure from the outside threats. I will not dwell into it. On economy side, we fully understand that we need to reach a certain level in our economic development in order to be part of European Union. For example, I remember in 2009, I made a calculation for myself. What if tomorrow European Union decides to accept Georgia? What the Georgian economy should look like? And I took two numbers from the least developed country, which was Bulgaria, adopted into the European Union. And I took two criteria. One was the trade between Bulgaria and the rest of the European Union at that time. It was 60%. Of Bulgaria's trade was with European Union before Bulgaria exceeded European Union. In our case, we are far from it yet. So it's around 30%, if I remember the number now correctly, because Turkey has free trade with us, and Turkey has also the same with European Union. Then if you include Turkey as well, then we can reach 60%, but still we underdeveloped economically in order to join European Union. And second was what our GDP per capita has to look like, and we are also far from it. So my answer to your question would be that we need rapid growth before joining European Union. And of course, this rapid growth has to be achieved with least regulated economy, because if we join, I dream joining European Union for Georgia, but if we join tomorrow within the regulatory setup European Union has, I suspect that our growth cannot be the same. We need to reach at least Bulgaria's point economically before European Brussels makes political decisions accepting Georgia within its own ranks.
And that concludes this week's episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. Please follow Zurab Chabiashvili at ZTCH on Twitter. And of course, follow the Consumer Choice Center as well at Consumer Choice C. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have-